He? That's a tradesman. That is to say, he's the restaurant keeper, Verestchagin. Perhaps you have heard of that affair with the proclamation. Oh, so that is Verestchagin, said Pierre, looking at the firm, calm face of the old man and seeking any indication of his being a traitor. Oh, that's not he himself. That's the father of the fellow who wrote the proclamation, said the adjutant. The young man is in prison, and I expect it will go hard with him. An old gentleman wearing a star and another official, a German wearing a cross round his neck, approached the speaker. It's a complicated story, you know, said the adjutant. That proclamation appeared about 2 months ago. The Count was informed of it. He gave orders to investigate the matter. Gabriel Ivanovich here made the inquiries. The proclamation had passed through exactly 63 hands. He asked one, from whom did you get it? From so-and-so. He went to the next one, from whom did you get it? And so on, till he reached Verestchagin, a half-educated tradesman, you know. A pet of a trader, said the adjutant, smiling. They asked him, who gave it you? And the point is that we knew whom he had it from. He could only have had it from the postmaster. But evidently, they had come to some understanding. He replied, from no one. I made it up myself. They threatened and questioned him, but he stuck to that. I made it up myself. And so it was reported to the Count, who sent for the man. From whom did you get the proclamation? I wrote it myself. Well, you know, the Count, said the adjutant cheerfully, with a smile of pride. He flared up dreadfully. And just think of the fellow's audacity, his lying and obstinacy. And the Count wanted him to say it was from Klucharyov? I understand, said Pierre. Not at all, rejoined the adjutant in dismay. Klucharyov had his own sins to answer for without that, and that is why he's been banished. But the point is that the Count was much annoyed. How could you have written it yourself, said he. And he took up the Hamburg Gazette that was lying on the table. Here it is. You did not write it yourself, but translated it, and translated it abominably, because you don't even know French, you fool. And what do you think? No, said he, I've not read any papers. I made it up myself. If that's so, you're a traitor, and I'll have you tried, and you'll be hanged. Say from whom you had it. I've seen no papers. I made it up myself. And that was the end of it. The Count had the father fetched, but the fellow stuck to it. He was sent for trial and condemned to hard labor, I believe. Now the father has come to intercede for him. But he's a good-for-nothing lad. You know that sort of tradesman's son, a dandy and lady-killer. He attended some lectures somewhere and imagines that the devil is no match for him. That's the sort of fellow he is. His father keeps a cook-shop here by the stone bridge, and you know there was a large icon of God Almighty painted with a scepter in one hand and an orb in the other? Well, he took that icon home with him for a few days, and what did he do? He found some scoundrel of a painter. In the middle of this fresh tale, Pierre was summoned to the commander-in-chief. When he entered the private room, Count Rostopchin, puckering his face, was rubbing his forehead and eyes with his hand. A short man was saying something, but when Pierre entered, he stopped speaking and went out. "Ah, how do you do, great warrior?" said Rostopchin as soon as the short man had left the room. "We've heard of your prowess, but that's not the point. Between ourselves, mon cher, do you belong to the Masons?" He went on severely, as though there was something wrong about it, which he nevertheless intended to pardon. Pierre remained silent. "I'm well informed, my friend, but I'm aware that there are Masons and Masons, and I hope that you're not one of those who, on pretense of saving mankind, wish to ruin Russia." "Yes, I'm a Mason," Pierre replied. "There, you see, mon cher. I expect you know that Messieurs Speransky and Magnitsky have been deported to their proper place. Mr. Klucharyov has been treated in the same way, and so have others who, on the plea of building up the Temple of Solomon, have tried to destroy the temple of their fatherland. You can understand that there are reasons for this, and that I could not have exiled the postmaster had he not been a harmful person. It has now come to my knowledge that you lent him your carriage for his removal from town, and that you have even accepted papers from him for safe custody. I like you and don't wish you any harm, and as you're only half my age, I advise you, as a father would, to cease all communication with men of that stamp, and to leave here as soon as possible. But what did Klucharyov do wrong, Count? Asked Pierre. "That is for me to know, but not for you to ask," shouted Rostopchin. "If he's accused of circulating Napoleon's proclamation, it is not proved that he did so," said Pierre, without looking at Rostopchin. "And Verestchagin..." "There we are!" Rostopchin shouted at Pierre louder than before, frowning suddenly. "Verestchagin is a renegade and a traitor who will be punished as he deserves," said he with the vindictive heat with which people speak when recalling an insult. "But I did not summon you to discuss my actions, but to give you advice, or an order, if you prefer it. I beg you to leave the town and break off all communication with such men as Klucharyov. And I will knock the sense out of anybody..." But probably realizing that he was shouting at Bezukhov, who so far was not guilty of anything, he added, taking Pierre's hand in a friendly manner, "We're on the eve of a public disaster, and I haven't time to be polite to everybody who has business with me. My head is sometimes in a whirl. Well, mon cher, what are you doing personally?" "Why, nothing," answered Pierre, without raising his eyes or changing the thoughtful expression of his face. The Count frowned. "A word of friendly advice, mon cher. Be off as soon as you can. That's all I have to tell you. Happy he who has ears to hear. Goodbye, my dear fellow. Oh, by the by," he shouted through the doorway after Pierre, "is it true that the Countess has fallen into the clutches of the Holy Fathers of the Society of Jesus?" Pierre did not answer, and left Rostopchin's room more sullen and angry than he had ever before shown himself. When he reached home, it was already getting dark. Some 8 people had come to see him that evening: the secretary of a committee, the colonel of his battalion, his steward, his major domo, and various petitioners. They all had business with Pierre and wanted decisions from him. Pierre did not understand and was not interested in any of these questions, and only answered them in order to get rid of these people. When left alone at last, he opened and read his wife's letter. "They, the soldiers at the battery, Prince Andrew killed, that old man. Simplicity is submission to God. Suffering is necessary, the meaning of all. One must harness. My wife is getting married. One must forget and understand." And going to his bed, he threw himself on it without undressing, and immediately fell asleep. When he awoke next morning, the major domo came to inform him that a special messenger, a police officer, had come from Count Rostopchin to know whether Count Bezukhov had left or was leaving the town. 12 persons who had business with Pierre were awaiting him in the drawing room. Pierre dressed hurriedly, and instead of going to see them, went to the back porch and out through the gate. From that time till the end of the destruction of Moscow, no one of Bezukhov's household, despite all the search they made, saw Pierre again or knew where he was. Chapter 8. The Rostovs, packing up and leaving Moscow. They allow wounded officers to stay in their house and avail themselves of their carts to leave Moscow. Berg's wish to borrow a cart. Natasha, when leaving Moscow, sees and speaks to Pierre. Prince Andrew travels in their train of vehicles. The Rostovs remained in Moscow till the 1st of September, that is, till the eve of the enemy's entry into the city. After Petya had joined Obolensky's regiment of Cossacks and left for Bielaya Tserkov, where that regiment was forming, the Countess was seized with terror. The thought that both her sons were at the war had both gone from under her wing, that today or tomorrow either or both of them might be killed, like the 3 sons of one of her acquaintances, struck her that summer for the first time with cruel clearness. She tried to get Nicholas back, and wished to go herself to join Petya, or to get him an appointment somewhere in Petersburg, but neither of these proved possible. Petya could not return unless his regiment did so, or unless he was transferred to another regiment on active service. Nicholas was somewhere with the army and had not sent a word since his last letter, in which he had given a detailed account of his meeting with Princess Mary. The Countess did not sleep at night, or when she did fall asleep, dreamed that she saw her sons lying dead. After many consultations and conversations, the Count at last devised means to tranquilize her. He got Petya transferred from Obolensky's regiment to Bezukhov's, which was in training near Moscow. Though Petya would remain in the service, this transfer would give the Countess the consolation of seeing at least one of her sons under her wing, and she hoped to arrange matters for her Petya so as not to let him go again, but always get him appointed to places where he could not possibly take part in a battle. As long as Nicholas alone was in danger, the Countess imagined that she loved her firstborn more than all her other children, and even reproached herself for it. But when her youngest, the scapegrace who had been bad at lessons, was always breaking things in the house and making himself a nuisance to everybody, that snub-nosed Petya, with his merry black eyes and fresh rosy cheeks, where soft down was just beginning to show, when he was thrown amid those big, dreadful, cruel men who were fighting somewhere about something and apparently finding pleasure in it, then his mother thought she loved him more, much more than all her other children. The nearer the time came for Petya to return, the more uneasy grew the Countess. She began to think she would never live to see such happiness. The presence of Sonya, of her beloved Natasha, or even of her husband, irritated her. "What do I want with them? I want no one but Petya," she thought. At the end of August, the Rostovs received another letter from Nicholas. He wrote from the province of Voronezh, where he had been sent to procure remounts. But that letter did not set the Countess at ease. Knowing that one son was out of danger, she became the more anxious about Petya. Though by the 20th of August nearly all the Rostovs' acquaintances had left Moscow, and though everybody tried to persuade the Countess to get away as quickly as possible, she would not hear of leaving before her treasure, her adored Petya, returned. On the 28th of August, he arrived. The passionate tenderness with which his mother received him did not please the 16-year-old officer. Though she concealed from him her intention of keeping him under her wing, Petya guessed her designs, and, instinctively fearing that he might give way to emotion when with her, might become womanish, as he termed it to himself, he treated her coldly, avoided her, and during his stay in Moscow attached himself exclusively to Natasha, for whom he had always had a particularly brotherly tenderness, almost lover-like. Owing to the Count's customary carelessness, nothing was ready for their departure by the 28th of August, and the carts that were to come from their Ryazan and Moscow estates to remove their household belongings did not arrive till the 30th. From the 28th till the 31st, all Moscow was in a bustle and commotion. Every day, thousands of men wounded at Borodino were brought in by the Dorogomilov gate and taken to various parts of Moscow, and thousands of carts conveyed the inhabitants and their possessions out by the other gates. In spite of Rostopchin's broadsheets, or because of them, or independently of them, the strangest and most contradictory rumors were current in the town. Some said that no one was to be allowed to leave the city. Others, on the contrary, said that all the icons had been taken out of the churches and everybody was to be ordered to leave. Some said there had been another battle after Borodino, at which the French had been routed, while others, on the contrary, reported that the Russian army had been destroyed. Some talked about the Moscow militia, which, preceded by the clergy, would go to the Three Hills. Others whispered that Augustine, the Archbishop of Moscow, had been forbidden to leave, that traitors had been seized, that the peasants were rioting and robbing people on their way from Moscow, and so on. But all this was only talk. In reality, though the Council of Filí, at which it was decided to abandon Moscow, had not yet been held, both those who went away and those who remained behind felt, though they did not show it, that Moscow would certainly be abandoned, and that they ought to get away as quickly as possible and save their belongings. It was felt that everything would suddenly break up and change, but up to the 1st of September, nothing had done so. As a criminal who is being led to execution knows that he must die immediately, but yet looks about him and straightens the cap that is awry on his head, so Moscow involuntarily continued its wonted life, though it knew that the time of its destruction was near, when the conditions of life to which its people were accustomed to submit would be completely upset. During the 3 days preceding the occupation of Moscow, the whole Rostov family was absorbed in various activities. The head of the family, Count Ilya Rostov, continually drove about the city collecting the current rumors from all sides and gave superficial and hasty orders at home about the preparations for their departure. The Countess watched the things being packed, was dissatisfied with everything, was constantly in pursuit of Petya, who was always running away from her, and was jealous of Natasha, with whom he spent all his time. Sonya alone directed the practical side of matters by getting things packed. But of late, Sonya had been particularly sad and silent. Nicholas's letter, in which he mentioned Princess Mary, had elicited in her presence joyous comments from the Countess, who saw an intervention of Providence in this meeting of the Princess and Nicholas. "I was never pleased at Bolkonski's engagement to Natasha," said the Countess, "but I always wanted Nicholas to marry the Princess, and had a presentiment that it would happen. What a good thing it would be!" Sonya felt that this was true, that the only possibility of retrieving the Rostovs' affairs was by Nicholas marrying a rich woman, and that the Princess was a good match. It was very bitter for her, but despite her grief, or perhaps just because of it, she took on herself all the difficult work of directing the storing and packing of their things, and was busy for whole days. The Count and Countess turned to her when they had any orders to give. Petya and Natasha, on the contrary, far from helping their parents, were generally a nuisance and a hindrance to everyone. Almost all day long the house resounded with their running feet, their cries, and their spontaneous laughter. They laughed and were gay, not because there was any reason to laugh, but because gaiety and mirth were in their hearts, and so everything that happened was a cause for gaiety and laughter to them. Petya was in high spirits because, having left home a boy, he had returned, as everybody told him, a fine young man. Because he was at home, because he had left Bielaya Tserkov, where there was no hope of soon taking part in a battle, and had come to Moscow, where there was to be fighting in a few days, and chiefly because Natasha, whose lead he always followed, was in high spirits. Natasha was gay, because she had been sad too long, and now nothing reminded her of the cause of her sadness, and because she was feeling well. She was also happy because she had someone to adore her. The adoration of others was a lubricant the wheels of her machine needed to make them run freely, and Petya adored her. Above all, they were gay because there was a war near Moscow. There would be fighting at the town gates, arms were being given out, everybody was escaping, going away somewhere, and in general, something extraordinary was happening, and that is always exciting, especially to the young. On Saturday, the 31st of August, everything in the Rostovs' house seemed topsy-turvy. All the doors were open, all the furniture was being carried out or moved about, and the mirrors and pictures had been taken down. There were trunks in the rooms, and hay, wrapping paper, and ropes were scattered about. The peasants and house serfs, carrying out the things, were treading heavily on the parquet floors. The yard was crowded with peasant carts, some loaded high and already corded up, others still empty. The voices and footsteps of the many servants and of the peasants who had come with the carts resounded as they shouted to one another in the yard and in the house. The Count had been out since morning. The Countess had a headache brought on by all the noise and turmoil, and was lying down in the new sitting room with a vinegar compress on her head. Petya was not at home. He had gone to visit a friend with whom he meant to obtain a transfer from the militia to the active army. Sonya was in the ballroom looking after the packing of the glass and china. Natasha was sitting on the floor of her dismantled room, with dresses, ribbons, and scarves strewn all about her, gazing fixedly at the floor, and holding in her hands the old ball dress, already out of fashion, which she had worn at her first Petersburg ball. Natasha was ashamed of doing nothing when everyone else was so busy, and several times that morning had tried to set to work. But her heart was not in it, and she could not and did not know how to do anything except with all her heart and all her might. For a while she had stood beside Sonya while the china was being packed and tried to help, but soon gave it up and went to her room to pack her own things. At first she found it amusing to give away dresses and ribbons to the maids, but when that was done and what was left had still to be packed, she found it dull. "Dunyasha, you pack. You will, won't you, dear?" And when Dunyasha willingly promised to do it all for her, Natasha sat down on the floor, took her old ball dress, and fell into a reverie quite unrelated to what ought to have occupied her thoughts now. She was roused from her reverie by the talk of the maids in the next room, which was theirs, and by the sound of their hurried footsteps going to the back porch. Natasha got up and looked out of the window. An enormously long row of carts full of wounded men had stopped in the street. The housekeeper, the old nurse, the cooks, coachmen, maids, footmen, postilions, and scullions stood at the gate, staring at the wounded. Natasha, throwing a clean pocket handkerchief over her hair and holding an end of it in each hand, went out into the street. The former housekeeper, old Mavra Kuzminichna, had stepped out of the crowd by the gate, gone up to a cart with a hood constructed of bast mats, and was speaking to a pale young officer who lay inside. Natasha moved a few steps forward and stopped shyly, still holding her handkerchief, and listened to what the housekeeper was saying. "Then you have nobody in Moscow?" she was saying. "You would be more comfortable somewhere in a house. In ours, for instance. The family are leaving." "I don't know if it would be allowed," replied the officer in a weak voice. "Here's our commanding officer. Ask him." And he pointed to a stout major who was walking back along the street past the row of carts. Natasha glanced with frightened eyes at the face of the wounded officer and at once went to meet the major. "May the wounded men stay in our house?" she asked. The major raised his hand to his cap with a smile. "Which one do you want, mademoiselle?" said he, screwing up his eyes and smiling. Natasha quietly repeated her question, and her face and whole manner were so serious, though she was still holding the ends of her handkerchief, that the major ceased smiling, and after some reflection, as if considering in how far the thing was possible, replied in the affirmative. "Oh yes, why not? They may," he said. With a slight inclination of her head, Natasha stepped back quickly to Mavra Kuzminichna, who stood talking compassionately to the officer. "They may. He says they may," whispered Natasha. The cart in which the officer lay was turned into the Rostovs' yard, and dozens of carts with wounded men began at the invitation of the townsfolk to turn into the yards and to draw up at the entrances of the houses in Povarskaya Street. Natasha was evidently pleased to be dealing with new people outside the ordinary routine of her life. She and Mavra Kuzminichna tried to get as many of the wounded as possible into their yard. "Your papa must be told, though," said Mavra Kuzminichna. "Never mind, never mind. What does it matter? For one day we can move into the drawing room. They can have all our half of the house." "There now, young lady, you do take things into your head. Even if we put them into the wing, the men's room or the nurse's room, we must ask permission." "Well, I'll ask." Natasha ran into the house and went on tiptoe through the half-open door into the sitting room, where there was a smell of vinegar and Hoffman's drops. "Are you asleep, Mama?" "Oh, what sleep," said the Countess, waking up just as she was dropping into a doze. "Mama, darling," said Natasha, kneeling by her and bringing her face close to her mother's. "I'm sorry, forgive me. I'll never do it again. I woke you up. Mavra Kuzminichna has sent me. They've brought some wounded here. Officers, will you let them come? They've nowhere to go. I knew you'd let them come," she said quickly, all in one breath. "What officers? Whom have they brought? I don't understand anything about it," said the Countess. Natasha laughed, and the Countess, too, smiled slightly. "I knew you'd give your permission, so I'll tell them." And having kissed her mother, Natasha got up and went to the door. In the hall she met her father, who had returned with bad news. "We've stayed too long," said the Count with involuntary vexation. "The club is closed and the police are leaving." "Papa, is it all right? I've invited some of the wounded into the house," said Natasha. "Of course it is," he answered absently. "It's not the point. I beg you not to indulge in trifles now, but to help to pack, and tomorrow we must go, go, go." And the Count gave a similar order to the major domo and the servants. At dinner, Petya, having returned home, told them the news he had heard. He said the people had been getting arms in the Kremlin, and that though Rostopchin's broadsheet had said that he would sound a call 2 or 3 days in advance, the order had certainly already been given for everyone to go armed to the Three Hills tomorrow, and that there would be a big battle there. The Countess looked with timid horror at her son's eager, excited face as he said this. She realized that if she said a word about his not going to the battle, she knew he enjoyed the thought of the impending engagement, he would say something about men, honor, and the fatherland, something senseless, masculine, and obstinate, which there would be no contradicting, and her plans would be spoiled. And so, hoping to arrange to leave before then and take Petya with her as their protector and defender, she did not answer him, but after dinner called the Count aside and implored him with tears to take her away quickly, that very night if possible. With a woman's involuntary loving cunning, she, who till then had not shown any alarm, said that she would die of fright if they did not leave that very night. Without any pretense, She was now afraid of everything. Madame Schoss, who had been out to visit her daughter, increased the Countess's fears still more by telling what she had seen at a spirit dealer's in Myasnitsky Street. When returning by that street, she had been unable to pass because of a drunken crowd rioting in front of the shop. She had taken a cab and driven home by a side street, and the cabman had told her that the people were breaking open the barrels at the drink store, having received orders to do so. After dinner, the whole Rostov household set to work with enthusiastic haste, packing their belongings and preparing for their departure. The old count, suddenly setting to work, kept passing from the yard to the house and back again, shouting confused instructions to the hurrying people and flurrying them still more. Petya directed things in the yard. Sonya, owing to the count's contradictory orders, lost her head and did not know what to do. The servants ran noisily about the house and yard, shouting and disputing. At first, her intervention in the business of packing was received skeptically. Everybody expected some prank from her and did not wish to obey her. But she resolutely and passionately demanded obedience, grew angry and nearly cried because they did not heed her, and at last succeeded in making them believe her. Her first exploit, which cost her immense effort and established her authority, was the packing of the carpets. The Count had valuable Gobelin tapestries and Persian carpets in the house. When Natasha set to work, two cases were standing open in the ballroom, one almost full up with crockery, the other with carpets. There was also much china standing on the tables, and still more was being brought in from the storeroom. A third case was needed, and servants had gone to fetch it. "Sonya, wait a bit. We'll pack everything into these," said Natasha. "Well, you can't, miss. We've tried to," said the butler's assistant. "No, wait a minute, please." And Natasha began rapidly taking out of the case dishes and plates wrapped in paper. "The dishes must go in here among the carpets," said she. "Why, it's a mercy if we can get the carpets alone into three cases," said the butler's assistant. "Oh, wait, please." And Natasha began rapidly and deftly sorting out the things. "These aren't needed," said she, putting aside some plates of Kiev ware. "These? Yes, these must go among the carpets," she said, referring to the Saxony china dishes. "Don't, Natasha. Leave it alone. We'll get it all packed," urged Sonya reproachfully. "What a young lady she is," remarked the major domo. But Natasha would not give in. She turned everything out and began quickly repacking, deciding that the inferior Russian carpets and unnecessary crockery should not be taken at all. When everything had been taken out of the cases, they recommenced packing, and it turned out that when the cheaper things not worth taking had nearly all been rejected, the valuable ones really did all go into the two cases. Only the lid of the case containing the carpets would not shut down. A few more things might have been taken out, but Natasha insisted on having her own way. She packed, repacked, pressed, made the butler's assistant and Petya, whom she had drawn into the business of packing, press on the lid, and made desperate efforts herself. "That's enough, Natasha," said Sonya. "I see you were right, but just take out the top one." "I won't," cried Natasha, with one hand holding back the hair that hung over her perspiring face, while with the other she pressed down the carpets. "Now press, Petya, press, Vasilich, press hard," she cried. The carpets yielded, and the lid closed. Natasha, clapping her hands, screamed with delight, and tears fell from her eyes. But this only lasted a moment. She at once set to work afresh, and they now trusted her completely. The Count was not angry even when they told him that Natasha had countermanded an order of his, and the servants now came to her to ask whether a cart was sufficiently loaded and whether it might be corded up. Thanks to Natasha's directions, the work now went on expeditiously. Unnecessary things were left, and the most valuable packed as compactly as possible. But hard as they all worked till quite late that night, they could not get everything packed. The Countess had fallen asleep, and the Count, having put off their departure till next morning, went to bed. Sonya and Natasha slept in the sitting room without undressing. That night, another wounded man was driven down the Povarskaya, and Mavra Kuzminichna, who was standing at the gate, had him brought into the Rostovs' yard. Mavra Kuzminichna concluded that he was a very important man. He was being conveyed in a calèche with a raised hood and was quite covered by an apron. On the box beside the driver sat a venerable old attendant. A doctor and two soldiers followed the carriage in a cart. "Please come in here. The masters are going away. and the whole house will be empty," said the old woman to the old attendant. "Well, perhaps," said he with a sigh. "We don't expect to get him home alive. We have a house of our own in Moscow, but it's a long way from here, and there's nobody living in it. Do us the honour to come in. There's plenty of everything in the master's house." "Come in," said Mavra Kuzminichna. "Is he very ill?" she asked. The attendant made a hopeless gesture. "We don't expect to get him home. We must ask the doctor." And the old servant got down from the box and went up to the cart. "All right," said the doctor. The old servant returned to the calèche, looked into it, shook his head disconsolately, told the driver to turn into the yard, and stopped beside Mavra Kuzminichna. "O Lord Jesus Christ," she murmured. She invited them to take the wounded man into the house. "The masters won't object," she said. But they had to avoid carrying the man upstairs, and so they took him into the wing and put him in the room that had been Madame Schoss's. This wounded man was Prince Andrew Bolkonski. Moscow's last day had come. It was a clear, bright autumn day, a Sunday. The church bells everywhere were ringing for service, just as usual on Sundays. Nobody seemed yet to realize what awaited the city. Only two things indicated the social condition of Moscow: the rabble, that is, the poor people, and the price of commodities. An enormous crowd of factory hands, house serfs, and peasants, with whom some officials, seminarists, and gentry were mingled, had gone early that morning to the Three Hills. Having waited there for Rostopchin, who did not turn up, they became convinced that Moscow would be surrendered, and then dispersed all about the town to the public houses and cookshops. Prices, too, that day indicated the state of affairs. The price of weapons, of gold, of carts and horses kept rising, but the value of paper money and city articles kept falling, so that by midday there were instances of carters removing valuable goods such as cloth and receiving in payment a half of what they carted, while peasant horses were fetching 500 rubles each, and furniture, mirrors, and bronzes were being given away for nothing. In the Rostovs' staid, old-fashioned house, the dissolution of former conditions of life was but little noticeable. As to the serfs, the only indication was that three out of their huge retinue disappeared during the night, but nothing was stolen. And as to the value of their possessions, the 30 peasant carts that had come in from their estates, and which many people envied, proved to be extremely valuable, and they were offered enormous sums of money for them. Not only were huge sums offered for the horses and carts, but on the previous evening and early in the morning of the 1st of September, orderlies and servants sent by wounded officers came to the Rostovs' yard, and wounded men dragged themselves there from the Rostovs and from neighboring houses where they were accommodated, entreating the servants to try to get them a lift out of Moscow. The major domo, to whom these entreaties were addressed, though he was sorry for the wounded, resolutely refused, saying that he dare not even mention the matter to the Count. Pity these wounded men as one might, it was evident that if they were given one cart, there would be no reason to refuse another, or all the carts and one's own carriages as well. 30 carts could not save all the wounded, and in the general catastrophe one could not disregard oneself and one's own family. So thought the major domo on his master's behalf. On waking up that morning, Count Ilya Rostov left his bedroom softly so as not to wake the countess, who had fallen asleep only toward morning, and came out to the porch in his lilac silk dressing gown. In the yard stood the carts, ready corded. The carriages were at the front porch. The major domo stood at the porch talking to an elderly orderly and to a pale young officer with a bandaged arm. On seeing the count, the major domo made a significant and stern gesture to them both to go away. "Well, Vasilich, is everything ready?" asked the count, and stroking his bald head, he looked good-naturedly at the officer and the orderly and nodded to them. He liked to see new faces. "We can harness at once, Your Excellency." "Well, that's right. As soon as the Countess wakes, we'll be off, God willing. What is it, gentlemen?" he added, turning to the officer. "Are you staying in my house?" The officer came nearer, and suddenly his face flushed crimson. "Count, be so good as to allow me, for God's sake, to get into some corner of one of your carts. I've nothing here with me. I should be all right on a loaded cart. Before the officer had finished speaking, the orderly made the same request on behalf of his master.
Oh, yes, 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 said the Count hastily. I should be very pleased, very pleased. Vasilich, you'll see to it. Just unload one or two carts. Well, whatever, do what's necessary, said the Count, muttering some indefinite order.
But at the same moment, an expression of warm gratitude on the officer's face had already sealed the order. The Count looked around him. In the yard, at the gates, at the window of the wings, wounded officers and their orderlies were to be seen. They were all looking at the Count and moving toward the porch.
"Please step into the gallery, Your Excellency," said the Majordomo. "What are your orders about the pictures?"
The Count went into the house with him, repeating his order not to refuse the wounded who asked for a lift.
"Well, never mind. Some of the things can be unloaded," he added in a soft, confidential voice, as though afraid of being overheard.
At 9 o'clock, the Countess woke up, and Matryona Timofeyevna, who had been her lady's maid before her marriage and now performed a sort of chief gendarme's duty for her, came to say that Madame Schoss was much offended and the young lady's summer dresses could not be left behind. On inquiry, the Countess learned that Madame Schoss was offended because her trunk had been taken down from its cart and all the loads were being uncorded and the luggage taken out of the carts to make room for wounded men whom the Count, in the simplicity of his heart, had ordered that they should take with them. The Countess sent for her husband.
"What is this, my dear? I hear that the luggage is being unloaded. You know, my lover, I wanted to tell you, Countess, dear. An officer came to me to ask for a few carts for the wounded. After all, ours are things that can be bought, but think what being left behind means to them. Really, now, in our own yard, we asked them in ourselves, and there are officers among them. You know, I think, my dear, let them be taken. Well, where's the hurry?"
The Count spoke timidly, as he always did when talking of money matters. The Countess was accustomed to this tone as a precursor of news of something detrimental to the children's interests, such as the building of a new gallery or conservatory, the inauguration of a private theatre or an orchestra. She was accustomed always to oppose anything announced in that timid tone, and considered it her duty to do so. She assumed her dolefully submissive manner and said to her husband, "Listen to me, Count. You've managed matters so that we're getting nothing for the house, and now you wish to throw away all the children's property. You said yourself that we have 100,000 rubles worth of things in the house. I don't consent, my dear, I don't. Do as you please. It's the government's business to look after the wounded, they know that. Look at the Lopukhins opposite. They cleared out everything 2 days ago. That's what other people do. It's only we who are such fools. If you have no pity on me, have some for the children."
Flourishing his arms in despair, the Count left the room without replying.
"Papa, what are you doing that for?" asked Natasha, who had followed him into her mother's room.
"Nothing. Well, what business is it of yours?" muttered the Count angrily.
"But I heard," said Natasha. "Why does Mama object?"
"What business is it of yours?" cried the Count.
Natasha stepped up to the window and pondered.
"Papa, here's Berg coming to see us," said she, looking out of the window.
Berg, the Rostov son-in-law, was already a colonel wearing the orders of Vladimir and Anna, and he still filled the quiet and agreeable post of assistant to the head of the staff of the assistant commander of the 1st Division of the 2nd Army. On the 1st of September he had come to Moscow from the army. He had nothing to do in Moscow, but he had noticed that everyone in the army was asking for leave to visit Moscow and had something to do there, so he considered it necessary to ask for leave of absence for family and domestic reasons. Berg drove up to his father-in-law's house in his spruce little trap with a pair of sleek roans, exactly like those of a certain prince. He looked attentively at the carts in the yard, and while going up to the porch took out a clean pocket handkerchief and tied a knot in it. From the anteroom, Berg ran with smooth, though impatient, steps into the drawing-room, where he embraced the Count, kissed the hands of Natasha and Sonya, and hastened to inquire after Mama's health.
"Health at a time like this?" said the Count. "Come, tell us the news. Is the army retreating, or will there be another battle?"
"God Almighty alone can decide the fate of our fatherland, Papa," said Berg.
The army is burning with a spirit of heroism, and the leaders, so to say, have now assembled in council. No one knows what is coming. But in general, I can tell you, Papa, that such a heroic spirit, the truly antique valour of the Russian army, which it, he corrected himself, has shown or displayed in the battle of the 26th, there are no words worthy to do it justice. I tell you, Papa. He smote himself on the breast, as a general he had heard speaking had done, but Berg did it a trifle late, for he should have struck his breast at the words Russian army. I tell you frankly that we, the commanders, far from having to urge the men on or anything of that kind, could hardly restrain those exploits of antique valour, he went on rapidly. General Barclay de Tolly risked his life everywhere at the head of the troops, I can assure you. Our corps was stationed on the hillside. You can imagine. And Berg related all that he remembered of the various tales he had heard those days. Natasha watched him with an intent gaze that confused him, as if she were trying to find in his face the answer to some question. Altogether, such heroism as was displayed by the Russian warriors cannot be imagined or adequately praised, said Berg, glancing round at Natasha, and, as if anxious to conciliate her, replying to her intent look with a smile. "Russia is not in Moscow. She lives in the hearts of her sons. Isn't it so, Papa?" said he. Just then the Countess came in from the sitting-room with a weary and dissatisfied expression. Berg hurriedly jumped up, kissed her hand, asked about her health, and, swaying his head from side to side to express sympathy, remained standing beside her. "Yes, Mama, I tell you sincerely that these are hard and sad times for every Russian, but why are you so anxious? You have still time to get away." "I can't think what the servants are about," said the Countess, turning to her husband. "I've just been told that nothing is ready yet. Somebody, after all, must see to things. One misses Mitchenka at such times. There won't be any end to it." The Count was about to say something, but evidently restrained himself. He got up from his chair and went to the door. At that moment Berg drew out his handkerchief as if to blow his nose, and, seeing the knot in it, pondered, shaking his head sadly and significantly. "And I have a great favour to ask of you, Papa," said he. Said the Count, and stopped. "I was driving past Yusupov's house just now," said Berg with a laugh, "when the steward, a man I know, ran out and asked me whether I wouldn't buy something. I went in out of curiosity, you know, and there's a small chiffonier and a dressing table. You know how dear Vera wanted a chiffonier like that, and how we had a dispute about it." At the mention of the chiffonier and dressing table, Berg involuntarily changed his tone to one of pleasure at his admirable domestic arrangements. "And it's such a beauty. It pulls out and has a secret English drawer, you know, and dear Vera has long wanted one. I wish to give her a surprise, you see. I saw so many of those peasant carts in your yard. Please let me have one. I will pay the man well, and—" The Count frowned and coughed. "Ask the Countess. I don't give orders." "If it's inconvenient, please don't," said Berg. "Only I so wanted it for dear Vera's sake." "Oh, go to the devil, all of you. To the devil, the devil, the devil!" cried the old Count. "My head's in a whirl!" And he left the room. The Countess began to cry. "Yes, Mama, yes, these are very hard times," said Berg. Natasha left the room with her father, and, as if finding it difficult to reach some decision, first followed him and then ran downstairs. Petya was in the porch, engaged in giving out weapons to the servants who were to leave Moscow. The loaded carts were still standing in the yard. Two of them had been uncorded, and a wounded officer was climbing into one of them, helped by an orderly. "Do you know what it's about?" Petya asked Natasha. She understood that he meant what were their parents quarrelling about. She did not answer. "It's because Papa wanted to give up all the carts to the wounded," said Petya. "Vasilich told me. I consider," Natasha suddenly almost shouted, turning her angry face to Petya, "I consider it so horrid, so abominable, so— I don't know what. Are we despicable Germans?" Her throat quivered with convulsive sobs, and afraid of weakening and letting the force of her anger run to waste, she turned and rushed headlong up the stairs. Berg was sitting beside the Countess, consoling her with the respectful attention of a relative.
The Count, pipe in hand, was pacing up and down the room when Natasha, her face distorted by anger, burst in like a tempest and approached her mother with rapid steps. "It's horrid! It's abominable!" she screamed. You can't possibly have ordered it!" Berg and the Countess looked at her, perplexed and frightened. The Count stood still at the window and listened. "Mamma, it's impossible! See what is going on in the yard!" she cried. "They will be left! What's the matter with you? Who are they? What do you want?" "Why, the wounded! It's impossible, Mamma! It's monstrous! No, Mamma, darling, it's not the thing. Please forgive me, darling. Mamma, what does it matter what we take away? Only look what is going on in the yard. Mamma, it's impossible." The Count stood by the window and listened without turning round. Suddenly he sniffed and put his face closer to the window. The Countess glanced at her daughter, saw her face full of shame for her mother, saw her agitation, and understood why her husband did not turn to look at her now, and she glanced round, quite disconcerted. "Oh, do as you like. Am I hindering anyone?" she said, not surrendering at once. "Mamma, darling, forgive me." But the Countess pushed her daughter away and went up to her husband. "My dear, you order what is right. You know I don't understand about it," said she, dropping her eyes shamefacedly. The eggs are teaching the hen," muttered the Count through tears of joy, and he embraced his wife, who was glad to hide her look of shame on his breast. "Papa, Mamma, may I see to it? May I?" asked Natasha. "We will still take all the most necessary things." The Count nodded affirmatively, and Natasha, at the rapid pace at which she used to run when playing at tag, ran through the ballroom to the anteroom and downstairs into the yard. The servants gathered round Natasha, but could not believe the strange order she brought them until the Count himself, in his wife's name, confirmed the order to give up all the carts to the wounded and take the trunks to the storerooms. When they understood that order, the servants set to work at this new task with pleasure and zeal. It no longer seemed strange to them, but on the contrary, it seemed the only thing that could be done. Just as a quarter of an hour before, it had not seemed strange to anyone that the wounded should be left behind and the goods carted away, but that had seemed the only thing to do. The whole household, as if to atone for not having done it sooner, set eagerly to work at the new task of placing the wounded in the carts. The wounded dragged themselves out of their rooms and stood with pale but happy faces round the carts. The news that carts were to be had spread to the neighboring houses, from which wounded men began to come into the Rostovs' yard. Many of the wounded asked them not to unload the carts, but only to let them sit on the top of the things. But the work of unloading, once started, could not be arrested. It seemed not to matter whether all or only half the things were left behind. Cases full of china, bronzes, pictures, and mirrors that had been so carefully packed the night before now lay about the yard, and still they went on searching for and finding possibilities of unloading this or that and letting the wounded have another and yet another cart. "We can take 4 more men," said the steward. "They can have my trap, or else what is to become of them?" "Let them have my wardrobe cart," said the Countess. "Dunyasha can go with me in the carriage." They unloaded the wardrobe cart and sent it to take wounded men from a house 2 doors off. The whole household, servants included, was bright and animated. Natasha was in a state of rapturous excitement such as she had not known for a long time. "What could we fasten this on to?" asked the servants, trying to fix a trunk on the narrow footboard behind a carriage. "We must keep at least 1 cart." "What's in it?" asked Natasha. "The Count's books." "Leave it. Vasilich will put it away. It's not wanted." The phaeton was full of people, and there was a doubt as to where Count Peter could sit. "On the box, you'll sit on the box, won't you, Petya?" cried Natasha. Sonya, too, was busy all this time, but the aim of her efforts was quite different from Natasha's. She was putting away the things that had to be left behind, and making a list of them as the Countess wished, and she tried to get as much taken away with them as possible. Before 2 o'clock in the afternoon, the Rostovs' 4 carriages, packed full and with the horses harnessed, stood at the front door. One by one the carts, with the wounded, had moved out of the yard. The calèche in which Prince Andrew was being taken attracted Sonya's attention as it passed the front porch. With the help of a maid, she was arranging a seat for the Countess in the huge, high coach that stood at the entrance. "Whose calèche is that?" she inquired, leaning out of the carriage window. "Why didn't you know, miss?" replied the maid. The wounded prince. He spent the night in our house and is going with us. But who is it? What's his name? It's our intended that was. Prince Bolkonski himself. They say he's dying, replied the maid with a sigh. Sonya jumped out of the coach and ran to the countess. The countess, tired out and already dressed in shawl and bonnet for her journey, was pacing up and down the drawing-room, waiting for the household to assemble for the usual silent prayer with closed doors before starting. Natasha was not in the room. Mama, said Sonya, Prince Andrew is here, mortally wounded. He's going with us. The countess opened her eyes in dismay and, seizing Sonya's arm, glanced around. Natasha, she murmured. At that moment, this news had only one significance for both of them. They knew their Natasha, and alarm as to what would happen if she heard this news stifled all sympathy for the man they both liked. Natasha does not know yet, but he's going with us, said Sonya. You say he's dying? Sonya nodded. The countess put her arms around Sonya and began to cry. The ways of God are past finding out, she thought, feeling that the almighty hand hitherto unseen was becoming manifest in all that was now taking place. Well, Mama, everything is ready. What's the matter? Asked Natasha, as with animated face she ran into the room. Nothing, answered the countess. If everything is ready, let us start. And the countess bent over her reticule to hide her agitated face. Sonya embraced Natasha and kissed her. Natasha looked at her inquiringly. What is it? What has happened? Nothing, no. Is it something very bad for me? What is it? Persisted Natasha with her quick intuition. Sonya sighed and made no reply. The count, Petya, Madame Schoss, Mavra Kuzminichna, and Vasilich came into the drawing-room, and having closed the doors, they all sat down and remained for some moments silently seated, without looking at one another. The count was the first to rise, and with a loud sigh crossed himself before the icon. All the others did the same. Then the count embraced Mavra Kuzminichna and Vasilich, who were to remain in Moscow, and while they caught at his hand and kissed his shoulder, he patted their backs lightly with some vaguely affectionate and comforting words. The countess went into the oratory, and there Sonya found her on her knees before the icons that had been left here and there hanging on the wall. The most precious ones, with which some family tradition was connected, were being taken with them. In the porch and in the yard, the men whom Petya had armed with swords and daggers, with trousers tucked inside their high boots and with belts and girdles tightened, were taking leave of those remaining behind. As is always the case at a departure, much had been forgotten or put in the wrong place, and for a long time two men-servants stood one on each side of the open door and the carriage steps, waiting to help the countess in, while maids rushed with cushions and bundles from the house to the carriages, the calèche, the phaeton, and back again. "They always will forget everything," said the countess. "Don't you know I can't sit like that?" And Dunyasha, with clenched teeth, without replying but with an aggrieved look on her face, hastily got into the coach to rearrange the seat. "Oh, those servants," said the count, swaying his head. Yefim, the old coachman, who was the only one the countess trusted to drive her, sat perched up high on the box and did not so much as glance round at what was going on behind him. From 30 years' experience, he knew it would be some time yet before the order, "Be off in God's name," would be given him. And he knew that, even when it was said, he would be stopped once or twice more while they sent back to fetch something that had been forgotten, and even after that he would again be stopped, and the countess herself would lean out of the window and beg him for the love of heaven to drive carefully down the hill. He knew all this, and therefore waited calmly for what would happen, with more patience than the horses, especially the near one, the chestnut Falcon, who was pawing the ground and champing his bit. At last all were seated. The carriage steps were folded and pulled up, the door was shut, somebody was sent for a travelling case, and the countess leaned out and said what she had to say. Then Yefim deliberately doffed his hat and began crossing himself. The postillion and all the other servants did the same. "Off, in God's name," said Yefim, putting on his hat. "Start!" The postillion started the horses, the off-pole horse tugged at his collar, the high springs creaked, and the body of the coach swayed. The footman, sprang onto the box of the moving coach, which jolted as it passed out of the yard onto the uneven roadway. The other vehicles jolted in their turn, and the procession of carriages moved up the street. In the carriages, the calèche and the phaeton all crossed themselves as they passed the church opposite the house. Those who were to remain in Moscow walked on either side of the vehicles, seeing the travellers off. Rarely had Natasha experienced so joyful a feeling as now, sitting in the carriage beside the countess and gazing at the slowly receding walls of forsaken, agitated Moscow. Occasionally she leaned out of the carriage window and looked back, and then forward at the long train of wounded in front of them. Almost at the head of the line she could see the raised hood of Prince Andrew's calèche. She did not know who was in it, but each time she looked at the procession her eyes sought that calèche. She knew it was right in front. In Kudrino, from the Nikitsky, Presnya, and Podnovinsk streets, came several other trains of vehicles similar to the Rostovs, and as they passed along the Sadovaya street, the carriages and carts formed two rows abreast. As they were going round the Sukharyev water tower, Natasha, who was inquisitively and alertly scrutinizing the people driving or walking past, suddenly cried out in joyful surprise, "Dear me, Mama, Sonia, look, it's he!"
"Who, who?"
"Look! Yes, on my word, it's Bezukhov," said Natasha, putting her head out of the carriage and staring at a tall, stout man in a coachman's long coat, who, from his manner of walking and moving, was evidently a gentleman in disguise, and who was passing under the arch of the Sukharyev Tower, accompanied by a small, sallow-faced, beardless old man in a frieze coat.
"Yes, it really is Bezukhov in a coachman's coat with a queer-looking old boy. Really," said Natasha, "look, look."
"No, it's not he. How can you talk such nonsense?"
"Mama," screamed Natasha, "I'll stake my head. It's he, I assure you."
"Stop, stop," she cried to the coachman. But the coachman could not stop, for from the Mishchansky street came more carts and carriages, and the Rostovs were being shouted at to move on and not block the way. In fact, however, though now much farther off than before, the Rostovs all saw Pierre, or someone extraordinarily like him, in a coachman's coat, going down the street with head bent and a serious face, beside a small, beardless old man who looked like a footman. That old man noticed a face thrust out of the carriage window gazing at them, and respectfully touching Pierre's elbow, said something to him, and pointed to the carriage. Pierre, evidently engrossed in thought, could not at first understand him. At length, when he had understood and looked in the direction the old man indicated, he recognized Natasha, and following his first impulse, stepped instantly and rapidly toward the coach. But having taken a dozen steps, he seemed to remember something and stopped. Natasha's face, leaning out of the window, beamed with quizzical kindliness.
"Peter Kirillovich, come here. We've recognized you. This is wonderful," she cried, holding out her hand to him. "What are you doing? Why are you like this?"
Pierre took her outstretched hand and kissed it awkwardly as he walked along beside her while the coach still moved on.
"What is the matter, Count?" asked the Countess in a surprised and commiserating tone.
"Don't ask me," said Pierre, and looked round at Natasha, whose radiant, happy expression, of which he was conscious without looking at her, filled him with enchantment.
"Are you remaining in Moscow, then?"
Pierre hesitated.
"In Moscow?" he said in a questioning tone. "Yes, in Moscow. Goodbye."
"If only I were a man, I'd certainly stay with you. How splendid," said Natasha. "Mama, if you'll let me, I'll stay."
Pierre glanced absently at Natasha and was about to say something, but the Countess interrupted him.
"You were at the battle, we heard."
"Yes, I was," Pierre answered. "There will be another battle tomorrow," he began, but Natasha interrupted him.
"But what is the matter with you, Count? You're not like yourself."
"Oh, don't ask me, don't ask me. I don't know myself. Tomorrow... No, goodbye, goodbye," he muttered. "It's an awful time." And dropping behind the carriage, he stepped onto the pavement. Natasha continued to lean out of the window for a long time, beaming at him with her kindly, slightly quizzical, happy smile. Chapter 9. Pierre at Bazdeyev's house. He wears a coachman's coat. For the last 2 days, ever since leaving home, Pierre had been living in the empty house of his deceased benefactor, Bazdeyev. This is how it happened. When he woke up on the morning after his return to Moscow and his interview with Count Rostopchin, he could not for some time make out where he was and what was expected of him. When he was informed that among others awaiting him in his reception room there was a Frenchman who had brought a letter from his wife, the Countess Hélène, he felt suddenly overcome by that sense of confusion and hopelessness to which he was apt to succumb. He felt that everything was now at an end, all was in confusion and crumbling to pieces, that nobody was right or wrong, the future held nothing, and there was no escape from this position. Smiling unnaturally and muttering to himself, he first sat down on the sofa in an attitude of despair, then rose, went to the door of the reception room and peeped through the crack, returned flourishing his arms, and took up a book. His majordomo came in a second time to say that the Frenchman who had brought the letter from the Countess was very anxious to see him, if only for a minute, and that someone from Bazdeyev's widow had called to ask Pierre to take charge of her husband's books, as she herself was leaving for the country. Oh, yes, in a minute. Wait, of course. Go and say I'll come directly, Pierre replied to the majordomo. But as soon as the man had left the room, Pierre took up his hat, which was lying on the table, and went out of his study by the other door. There was no one in the passage. He went along the whole length of this passage to the stairs, and, frowning and rubbing his forehead with both hands, went down as far as the first landing. The hall porter was standing at the front door. From the landing where Pierre stood, there was a second staircase leading to the back entrance. He went down that staircase and out into the yard. No one had seen him. But there were some carriages waiting, and as soon as Pierre stepped out of the gate, the coachman and the yard porter noticed him and raised their caps to him. When he felt he was being looked at, he behaved like an ostrich which hides its head in a bush in order not to be seen. He hung his head and, quickening his pace, went down the street. Of all the affairs awaiting Pierre that day, the sorting of Joseph Bazdeyev's books and papers appeared to him the most necessary. He hired the first cab he met and told the driver to go to the Patriarch's Ponds, where the widow Bazdeyev's house was. Continually turning round to look at the rows of loaded carts that were making their way from all sides out of Moscow, and balancing his bulky body so as not to slip out of the ramshackle old vehicle, Pierre, experiencing the joyful feeling of a boy escaping from school, began to talk to his driver. The man told him that arms were being distributed today at the Kremlin, and that tomorrow everyone would be sent out beyond the Three Hills gates, and a great battle would be fought there. Having reached the Patriarch's Ponds, Pierre found the Bazdeyev's house, where he had not been for a long time past. He went up to the gate. Gerasim, that sallow, beardless old man Pierre had seen at Torzhok 5 years before with Joseph Bazdeyev, came out in answer to his knock. "At home?" asked Pierre. "Owing to the present state of things, Sofya Danilovna has gone to the Torzhok estate with the children, Your Excellency." "I will come in all the same. I have to look through the books," said Pierre. "Be so good as to step in. Makar Alexeyevich, the brother of my late master, may the kingdom of heaven be his, has remained here, but he is in a weak state, as you know," said the old servant. Pierre knew that Makar Alexeyevich was Joseph Bazdeyev's half-insane brother and a hard drinker. "Yes, yes, I know. Let us go in," said Pierre, and entered the house. A tall, bald-headed old man with a red nose, wearing a dressing gown and with galoshes on his bare feet, stood in the anteroom. On seeing Pierre, he muttered something angrily and went away along the passage. "He was a very clever man, but has now grown quite feeble, as your honor sees," said Gerasim. "Will you step into the study?" Pierre nodded. "As it was sealed up, so it has remained, but Sofya Danilovna gave orders that if anyone should come from you, they were to have the books." Pierre went into that gloomy study which he had entered with such trepidation in his benefactor's lifetime. The room, dusty and untouched since the death of Joseph Bazdeyev, was now even gloomier. Gerasim opened one of the shutters and left the room on tiptoe. Pierre went round the study, approached the cupboard in which the manuscripts were kept, and took out what had once been one of the most important, the Holy of Holies of the Order. This was the authentic Scotch Acts, with Bazdeyev's notes and explanations. He sat down at the dusty writing table, and having laid the manuscripts before him, opened them out, closed them, finally pushed them away, and resting his head on his hand, sank into meditation. Gerasim looked cautiously into the study several times, and saw Pierre always sitting in the same attitude. More than 2 hours passed, and Gerasim took the liberty of making a slight noise at the door to attract his attention, but Pierre did not hear him.
"Is the cabman to be discharged, Your Honor?" "Oh, yes," said Pierre, rousing himself and rising hurriedly. "Look here," he added, taking Gerasim by a button of his coat and looking down at the old man with moist, shining, and ecstatic eyes. "I say, do you know that there's going to be a battle tomorrow?"
"We heard so," replied the man.
"I beg you not to tell anyone who I am, and to do what I ask you."
"Yes, Your Excellency," replied Gerasim. "Will you have something to eat?"
"No, but I want something else. I want peasant clothes and a pistol," said Pierre, unexpectedly blushing.
"Yes, Your Excellency," said Gerasim, after thinking for a moment.
All the rest of that day, Pierre spent alone in his benefactor's study, and Gerasim heard him pacing restlessly from one corner to another and talking to himself, and he spent the night on a bed made up for him there. Gerasim, being a servant who in his time had seen many strange things, accepted Pierre's taking up his residence in the house without surprise and seemed pleased to have someone to wait on. That same evening, without even asking himself what they were wanted for, he procured a coachman's coat and cap for Pierre and promised to get him the pistol next day. Makar Alexeyevich came twice that evening, shuffling along in his galoshes as far as the door, and stopped and looked ingratiatingly at Pierre. But as soon as Pierre turned toward him, he wrapped his dressing gown around him with a shamefaced and angry look and hurried away. It was when Pierre, wearing the coachman's coat which Gerasim had procured for him and had disinfected by steam, was on his way with the old man to buy the pistol at the Sukharyev market that he met the Rostovs. Chapter 10. Napoleon surveys Moscow from the Poklony Hill. He awaits a deputation of Les Boyards. Kutuzov's order to retreat through Moscow to the Ryazan Road was issued at night on the 1st of September. The first troop started at once, and during the night they marched slowly and steadily without hurry. At daybreak, however, those nearing the town at the Dorogomilov Bridge saw ahead of them masses of soldiers crowding and hurrying across the bridge, ascending on the opposite side and blocking the streets and alleys, while endless masses of troops were bearing down on them from behind, and an unreasoning hurry and alarm overcame them. They all rushed forward to the bridge, onto it, and to the fords and the boats. Kutuzov himself had driven round by side streets to the other side of Moscow. By 10 o'clock in the morning of the 2nd of September, only the rear guard remained in the Dorogomilov suburb, where they had ample room. The main army was on the other side of Moscow, or beyond it. At that very time, at 10 in the morning of the 2nd of September, Napoleon was standing among his troops on the Poklony Hill, looking at the panorama spread out before him. From the 26th of August to the 2nd of September, that is, from the Battle of Borodino to the entry of the French into Moscow, during the whole of that agitating, memorable week, there had been the extraordinary autumn weather that always comes as a surprise, when the sun hangs low and gives more heat than in spring, when everything shines so brightly in the rare, clear atmosphere that the eyes smart, when the lungs are strengthened and refreshed by inhaling the aromatic autumn air, when even the nights are warm, and when in those dark, warm nights, golden stars startle and delight us continually by falling from the sky. At 10 in the morning of the 2nd of September, this weather still held. The brightness of the morning was magical. Moscow, seen from the Poklony Hill, lay spaciously spread out with her river, her gardens, and her churches, and she seemed to be living her usual life, her cupolas glittering like stars in the sunlight. The view of the strange city with its peculiar architecture, such as he had never seen before, filled Napoleon with the rather envious and uneasy curiosity men feel when they see an alien form of life that has no knowledge of them. This city was evidently living with the full force of its own life. By the indefinite signs which even at a distance distinguish a living body from a dead one, Napoleon, from the Poklonny Hill, perceived the throb of life in the town, and felt, as it were, the breathing of that great and beautiful body. Every Russian looking at Moscow feels her to be a mother. Every foreigner who sees her, even if ignorant of her significance as the mother city, must feel her feminine character, and Napoleon felt it. Cette ville asiatique aux innombrables églises, Moscou la Sainte. La voilà donc enfin cette fameuse ville. Il était temps. That Asiatic city of the innumerable churches, holy Moscow, here it is then at last, that famous city. It was high time, said he, and dismounting, he ordered a plan of Moscow to be spread out before him, and summoned Lelorgne d'Ideville, the interpreter. A town captured by the enemy is like a maid who has lost her honor, thought he. He had said so to Tuchkov at Smolensk. From that point of view, he gazed at the oriental beauty he had not seen before. It seemed strange to him that his long-felt wish, which had seemed unattainable, had at last been realized. In the clear morning light he gazed now at the city and now at the plan, considering its details, and the assurance of possessing it agitated and awed him. But could it be otherwise, he thought. Here is this capital at my feet. Where is Alexander now, and of what is he thinking? A strange, beautiful, and majestic city, and a strange and majestic moment. In what light must I appear to them, thought he, thinking of his troops. Here she is, the reward for all those faint-hearted men, he reflected, glancing at those near him and at the troops who were approaching and forming up. One word from me, one movement of my hand, and that ancient capital of the Tsars would perish. But my clemency is always ready to descend upon the vanquished. I must be magnanimous and truly great. But no, it can't be true that I am in Moscow, he suddenly thought. Yet here she is, lying at my feet, with her golden domes and crosses scintillating and twinkling in the sunshine.